Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, everybody. This is Nazarita Goldhammer and Kevin Boyle, hosts at Epis Radio. It's July 29th. It's Monday. We're continuing our show on creativity, empathy, and human transformation. We've been talking a lot about this existential mode of having, having a glass of water, having a bank account, having an idea. Having a relationship. And if you look at the modern, a modern structural manifestation of this called capitalism, in which we live primarily in industrial, technological economies, we have formalized this notion of having. So when we have, we attach. And when we attach, we don't leave any room. In the attachment itself, we're waiving. We're putting to the side or bracketing a transcendental release of having. But people can get really caught up in having, right? People can get caught up in having a certain ideology. People can get caught up in having real estate, a house. They can get caught up in having a particular person as their partner or their spouse or friends or whatever it is, cars. And you can see how that can create a cesspool, right? I might have a certain set of ideas that work really well for me today, but they might not work for me very well next year. So if I'm unwilling to let go of those attachments or that havingness, then I'm in real trouble, because in that case, I'm clinging to possessiveness that no longer works for me. And so in capitalism, we interpret this existential mode of having, and we structuralize it. And there are all kinds of things that, or let's say other features that manifest, like survival of the fittest and competition and the quest to win, the quest to be better. This implies a view of the self as being highly individualist and autonomous. But that's problematic, because we're not just individuals. We're interrelational nodal points in complex interrelational dynamics. So you can see how this existential of having has, in its reverberations in the socioeconomic system, can be really problematic. And that's what we've been talking about, how capitalism is a deeper algorithm or deeper logic that almost operates as a substitute for transcendental freedom, transcendental empathy, a transcendental creativity. Here's here's a case in point. There's so many. And just keep in mind this constant quest to commodify and value every single thing. I remember, Nazarita, once upon a time when I was younger and people were going out into the job market. And I knew a good handful of people who were applying for jobs, and they might have gotten it down to maybe two jobs. And one job they really liked pay as much money as the second job. They took the second job because it paid more money, and they were miserable. And in the end, they didn't do very well, and they lost the job. And then the first job was no longer available. Or people will actually choose career paths that are based on potential revenue, potential income. I remember knowing somebody in my 20s who had thought that they were going to either go into business and go through a business education, or they were going to become an artist. They decided in the end to go through the business school because there was so much pressure to make money. There's some kind of a family esteem to make money. And years later, that person was really unhappy because they'd given up their creative life, the life as an artist. Or people will often make decisions based upon, quote, what's good for me, end quote. They'll make decisions based solely on income. You see that in politics, right, where one of the great tropes in American political, economical discussions is making a living. And it gets talked about that we have to make a living, and it starts to override other values. You see, some communities would continue to approve of coal plants or mines or various industrial plants that spewed pollution in the sky and the water. And that also polluted the bodies of the workers. But the trope of making a living subjugated those other truths. And that's a key point here. So we have this havingness, this desire to possess, held into place by this win-lose, competitive capitalism, and you can see how it overrides all other values. I'm thinking of people who go to L.A. wanting to make it big in the entertainment industry, and they end up taking money jobs that are they're not really what they want, and they lose their way. Or artists. People who have potential as artists end up doing commodified art, graphic design, that kind of thing, where they're not really exploring their skill. And so it operates as a logos. And that's what we're talking about. And welcome, Nazarita, here today. We're talking about how creativity and empathy and human transformation becomes subjugated by capitalism. You know, and I feel the tension in my own life. I can be honest about that. We do live in a capitalist structure, and there are plenty of geniuses on the street, very unhealthy. They're near death, but they're creative, and they do creative things. They don't go anywhere. So it's a constant tension between survival and creativity, empathy, and human transformation. And I guess another thing that I would say is we lose our empathy for animals. We put them in zoos. We put them in circuses. We lose our empathy for non-human beings because of money. People say, I need to make a living. Welcome to the show, Nazarita. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
It's a great subject, actually. And I'm reminded of, you know, Joseph Campbell, whom we've discussed many times. In his early life, he spent 5 years in a cabin in the woods reading and did, you know, odd jobs when he needed something. But they weren't jobs that were like 9 to 5 or took days and days. So he actually was able to spend 5 years reading. And I think of this, and he said later on in his life that nowadays, and this is when he was alive, that it wasn't possible to do that anymore. That we've actually robbed ourselves of time to actually think. And I think of, in this way, you know, Carl Jung spent time at his place building things and thinking and drawing and being creative. And I think of artists, writers, thinkers, philosophers, that you have to have time to actually think. And I'm also reminded of a contemporary thinker, and I used to really respond to their blogs, and then there was nothing thought through anymore. Like, it had run its course, and then I read that they had decided to take off a year in order to think. And I really applauded that, because when they came back, they had really thought. So it's this eternal busyness that we find ourselves in that causes us to stop our creative, critical thinking that blocks anything that is creative. I mean, the world that we've set up in the United States is basically a world where we're fighting to live. We're not really living. And so most people, most people spend their lives working, busy working, 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 working. And then they spend the time that they have off in entertainment, desiring a life that is different. And that's why in our culture, so many people look forward to retirement from a job that keeps them caged in from 9 to 5. And they can't wait to get free of that. And when they're free, they're faced with all these expectations and regrets that they didn't pursue when they were working. And so I've really advocated lately for changing the word work when people are doing something they're really passionate about, to change that word, because that carries with it this baggage of a 9 to 5, overtime, stressed, unable to appreciate the world, unable to live, filled with regrets at the end of your life. That's what work means, busyness, so that you're not capable of actually responding to the real world and to nature. And everything becomes something that you want, oh, give me that 10-second synopsis of everything, because we don't have time to actually really think critically anymore. So I'm reminded of that article by a really old article by Michael Ventura, saying someone is stealing your life. And the life that he proposes in this short little essay is that we are stealing our own life energy away by doing work all the time, and then expecting that in this little bit of time that we've allocated for pleasure or to be out in nature becomes something that carries with it overwhelming regret that we didn't live a life of thinking, of creativity, of writing, of really pursuing the higher things of which humans should be looking forward to. We should be saying, who are we? Where are we going? And instead, we keep going backwards into these old patterns of thinking. Most people are replicating things that have gone on for thousands and thousands of years. Wars and little cults of religion and fighting over whether you have a different color skin or hair or eyes, or that you like to read a book and they don't. I mean, we're quibbling with these minor things that are so ridiculous. We insist on murdering animals because maybe we think that our ancestors did. We refuse to change. And I think that if we can give ourselves the luxury, and this is where capitalism, where we have to fight certain effects of capitalism, because capitalism prohibits most people from being creative. And yet, the seed of capitalism is to say, you can live on being creative. And so, you know, in ancient cultures, they really revered creative artists. And they were taken care of because they provided the beauty and the depth of seeing the world with more cosmic eyes than people who didn't have that gift. I believe we all have that gift, and yet we prohibit ourselves from doing it. Instead, we want to pinch it into these Saturday and Sunday hours, or we're filled with regret, thinking that if we only had all this time, these are the things that we would do. We would take road trips. We would look at nature. We would go to Yellowstone. We would immerse ourselves in a book. But we rarely, rarely leave ourselves time for it. And I think that's the problem with our world today. It's in this competitive busyness work that prohibits real movement that is forward in our evolution. And I think that's a shame. And how do we get out of that?
Right. And so I think it's true that capitalism stifles empathy, right? Because people are so caught up in winning some illusory game, or they're caught up in their fear of survival. But those are all products that are epiphenomenal with a capitalism or just creativity in general. I mean, a lot of people give up so-called creativity for money. They like the narcotic effect of money. I've known lots of people in my life, not so many now, but definitely when I was younger, who were so caught up in the rush, compulsion of making a lot of money, that it really didn't matter that their marriage was falling apart, or that they were a drug addict, or that they were just basically not a very virtuous person. That rush of money, right, coming in, a lot of people are on that quest for that. You see it in the new television programs about selling real estate or selling money, you know, people making it. You know, there are famous designers who've made a lot of money. And what's interesting to me is people start talking about the money that these people are making, the billions of dollars, as opposed to the creative work they're doing. And so there's this really powerful discourse in capitalism commodification that is so, it's an erotic fixture. And it seems to override, you know, so many other values. And then if you think about what that does structurally to the government, the technology, the internet, how many different dimensions of capitalism we see, right? Or dimensions that are derivative of capitalism. it starts to invest your body, your mind, and then all this other experience of being human being, experience of human beingness, other meanings, mythologies, social meanings, cultural meanings, question about who we are, all those deeper questions that require us to be open and available to experience are subjugated. The very questions are subjugated. They're there. They're hidden. They're kind of wrapped up in the basement of a library. And then what we call critical thinking is constricted. It's constricted to making money. And so if somebody's wealthy, a lot of people say, well, he must be very smart. And that's not true at all. It means that that person has constricted his or her thinking in such a way that they're able to create a certain outcome. But what about the other values? And so I'm thinking values of empathy. Empathy, where we care about the whole more than we care about our own self. We care about other species. We care about other people more than we care about ourselves. And so you can see how people become numb, Nazarita, to feeling, having feelings for the other. It's a numbing effect. It becomes embodied. It becomes emotional. People become indifferent. They just don't care. And so that affects the way we are morally. We have, and then it's my view that creativity completely suffers, that it becomes almost like a non-value. Like, who cares about being creative if you're making a lot of money? It's true. People will actually switch off one set of neural networks and slip on the other. They just don't care about creativity and empathy anymore. And what's worse is that they don't care about human transformation. They start reading discourses that support and reinforce the idea that that's not so meaningful anyway. What's meaningful is having lots of money. And then you see that people fetishize it. And when I mean fetish, it's a word that we should always explain. To fetishize something means to give it an intrinsic value, when in reality, it has an instrumental value. For the sake of this conversation, that's what I mean. So if people like Donald Trump, for example, they have a fetish for money. They get a kind of a physical, visceral, mental response about making money. It triggers pleasure centers in the brain. So then, and Nazarita, this is what's worse, and I'll give the microphone back to you, but this is really what's worse. Out of all the things that we can say, we lose what I call a more primordial, authentic experience. And we give up a primordial, authentic relationship to the rest of life, to the biosphere, to ourselves, to all others, human and otherwise. So we have something that's not any longer an authentic relation. It is by definition an inauthentic relationship, because it's being mediated by this desire to have through capitalism. Now that's the other side of what we talked about last week. We start talking about metabolic rift in Marx. This is a straightforward concept that we can all share together. It's that we become unable to understand what's going on around us in the natural world. Because we've doped ourselves up in so many ways, all for this elusive goal of having. So now we're having something that's like a quasi-human experience. And so the idea is that inside our own being and inside our own social being, there's something really toxic and poisonous. Remember, we're talking about creativity, empathy, the willingness to transform towards the good. And that's my concern, you know, Nazarita, is that when you've created a type of human being and a type of society that it's very kernel, it's very core, very germ, it is inherently already inauthentic and toxic and aggressive and violent. It means that whatever we do, if that's your foundation for a society and for an individual, that it's going to be based upon that deep truth of that foundation. What do you think about that?
Well, say that last part again in a different way. That would be really helpful because it's such a potent subject. I'd like to just hear a few more thoughts on that.
Well, look at it this way. When you do anything in life, you do have a foundation. We call it first philosophy or first principles. When you do anything, when you become a professional in a certain industry, when you are a friend, when you get married, any part of life, whether it's sports, the play, having children, whatever project you have first principles, you have a foundation. We all agree on that. You know, unless we're drunk and stoned or seriously psychotic, we all have foundational principles. They're axioms. They're basic values and basic epistemological understandings of the world. Then we go out and do something. I'm making the claim that capitalism toxifies and poisons that foundation. That's the claim. That no matter what you go out to do with your life, that if your foundation is absorbed with having, possessing, if it's absorbed with commodifying, if it's absorbed in this win-lose game of amassing something, property, money, people, ideas, whatever it is, that it is at its very first step founded on an unsustainable starting point. That's what I'm saying. And so I'm tracing, taking a look at exploring capitalism and how it creates this toxic, distorted first principle. That's what I'm saying. And so the bigger claim that I was making, that I thought as I was saying it, as I think about it, that is so serious, it's that if that's our fundamental starting point in all of life experience, then we lose a deeper, more primordial, some people call it wild, but I call it authentic. We have a distorted relationship with ourselves and with reality in no matter what we do. And that's why I'm a little skeptical of Band-Aid programs, more superficial treatment options. If we don't look at the root cause of our discontent right now, our dystonia, our dysphoria, our dystopia, if we don't look at the root problem, which we can look at, which we can see, if we don't look at that, then no matter what we do, it's going to be poisoned and distorted. And so the deeper part of this is twofold. One, the very way we think about things will be distorted. And the number two, the very way we experience will be distorted. And we've talked about it. Capitalism puts one in a position of having to decide everything based upon whether it works for them or what's in it for them. That's a really interesting way of deciding anything. And you have even psychologists who buy into that illusion. We should be making decisions based upon the whole, based upon what is the good, what we think is good, based upon empathy, values that make us stronger and healthier. But we don't do that. Marriages are so commodified right now, right? And we know this. Many relationships are instrumentalized. People have no desire to make a friend unless that friend can do them something good. So we instrumentalize the most precious of all relationships, which is friendship. It is the sine qua non, friendship in the good. It is the height of all sublimity. And we've toxified it, distorted it, and poisoned it. So that's what I mean, Nasrita.
Okay. So, you know, this is why, it sounds really weird to say this, but this is why I like and really am interested in cataclysms and cataclysms of the earth, violent upheavals of the earth, which as humans, that's the way we look at it. I mean, it's a normal growth and experience of the earth to go through these different stages, but humans look at them as cataclysms because it affects them directly. And I'm really interested in those near-death experiences, health crisis, death. It's because what it does is it pulls you back to that which is beyond your set of principles that you think you have. It puts you in a way that says, what is really, really important? What in life is really important? All the so-called principles that people have, those all go out the door, every single one of them. And what they find in everything, the most important is the freedom of life in all species. It's like this this breath of fresh air. That's why I thought COVID was a really interesting experience. It prevented humans from, it stopped humans for a millisecond of continuing their conquest of Earth and other species. It prevented them, in which we saw nature start to rebound and to grow and to come out and to experience something different. And humans were locked away in their houses, which I thought was great because, there were no chemtrails in the air. There were hardly any cars on the street. The sky was bluer. Animals were out in the street being happy. And until that whole thing was over, then humans began their conquest of the earth again and of each other. This sort of take over everything till everything is bled dry and there's nothing left. And that's what I think the earth speaking, the aliveness of the earth itself speaks to that and says, stop what you're doing. Stop what you're doing. And listen differently, think differently. Think about every single thing in your life that you've built your supposed life on, right? And in terms of, like, I think of it like synesthesia. We think whatever we've read, that there are five senses. Well, that's absolutely amazingly ridiculous that we only have five senses. But you know, that's how we put them together. And we've totally ignored that we have this amazing synesthesia of where all of our senses are alive and combined together to have this experience as a different being. Like most non-human species, they have a synesthesia, which works very differently than the way humans have put their little stamp on our being that says everything is separate. And that's what we've done with our principles, with our relationships, and we still keep repeating this. And from that comes all these systems of government and governing, because we have to deal with people who are not humans, who are not evolved. Otherwise, we wouldn't need any of these things. But the fact that we need all of these things should tell us something at a very base evolutionary idea of where humans are really at. And humans put their need to control other humans, because we are so violent, onto other species. Oh, because we have to control humans, now we have to control other species too. And that's why I believe the world is in the state it's in, is that we replicate instead of going forward to something more creative, into more thinking, loving species. We keep going right back to this violent urge that we have to destroy other species and to destroy ourselves in the earth. And in effect, you know, we're going to be eliminated from the earth because of our hubris in thinking that we're the only thing that matters. You know, that our religions are the most important, the way we dress is the most important, the way we speak is the most important, where we live and how we cultivate the earth. It's like we're missing life itself. We're missing who we are. And it's just like you were talking about people who do things, and we've all had this experience of doing something because we were pressured to do it, thinking that that would make us more lovable, more appear better. But it doesn't. It just is this pressure. You know, so I know that there's lots of cataclysms going on now. Volcanoes are erupting, earthquakes, fires, and what they should be doing is bringing us back to something that is really important. What is life? How do we value life? What do we want to spend, you know, our life energy doing? I mean, what do we want to do? And I think that's a big question, isn't it? How do we want to live our lives? Who do we want to be? Who are we? You know, where are we going? And how are we going to get there?
Right. And so that question really becomes contracted into the capitalist commodification that we're talking about. You know, our ability to even have mental space is greatly constricted. It's greatly contracted. That's one of my really big concerns, is that it is so contracted, we're not able to think our way out of the situation we're in. But when you talk about cataclysm, it makes me think of my work as an analyst. I think of the words ontological rupture. And it totally works for me. An ontological rupture just means a rupture of our world. World destruction, right? Tsunami comes in, destroys the village. A volcano erupts. Town dies. You might have a forest fire. There's another cataclysm. But what's interesting, Nazarita, is that it's these cataclysms they're so overwhelming. And I was thinking about, if I recall my Confucianism, one of the tenets in Confucian wisdom is to be aware of what's next, what's coming, to not just be in the moment, but to also be in the past and the present at the same time. And what we learn in that kind of thinking is to read the signs, right? To read the signs. And I think capitalism makes us less perceptive about the signs. So, for example, there are people who are making money hand over fist right now, but greatly contributing to cataclysms in the world, you know, because of issues of global warming. They're contributing to the suffering of trillions of animals, but they're like inoculated by the inebriation of money. So we're not seeing as a culture and as a civilization what's right in front of our face. And knowing how life goes, if there's something that a person should be listening to in their own self, like from their unconscious, and they don't, by a degree of 10. And if we still don't listen, then it's a degree of 100. And if you apply that on a social scale, to be in denial and to be in avoidance about anything that's about ready to fracture leads to cataclysm. And it leads to that world rupture, that ontological rupture, a rupture in thinking, a rupture in being, rupture in worlding. And we're seeing it now, right, with all the fires across the world, especially in the United States and Canada. That, to me, that is a perfect example of the cataclysm that you're talking about. For most people, it would cause us to, you know, really take notice, right? Wow, why is this happening? Why did my town just burn down? What am I going to do now? COVID did that. I think, as you point out often, COVID was a great eye-opener, right? It drew our attention to thinking about what was important. And we're going to see more and more of that. And we may have to undergo even more serious degrees of cataclysm. Now, we're just about out of time. Do you want to make a final comment or give our listeners a question, Nazarita, that they can take with them today?
Well, my question is this. Why do we believe marketing and capitalism? Why do we believe that a certain car will make us more sexy? Why do we believe that certain clothes will make us appear a certain way? Why do we believe that romance movies, that our relationship should follow that line? Why do we believe those things? And why do we pursue them thinking that those are the ultimate? I find that to be an interesting question. Why do we believe that?
I think we're seeking new narratives, new stories, new mythologies. I think we're seeking meaning. This is a short answer. Because the meaning structures that we have now that stem from having capitalism are inherently distorted. People experientially don't get it, and cognitively we don't understand it, but there's something really distorted in our experience, and it's going to lead to further cataclysms and further violence. Bora, thank you, Nazarita. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to myself. This is Ephes Radio, and we will be back next Monday.